Welcome to STEM Spots, a weekly science review produced in cooperation with the Missouri State University Department of Physics, Astronomy, and Materials Science.
Hi, this is Dave Corniosen, and you are listening to STEM Spots, the web edition. With me in the studio today is Dr. Matthew McKay, who's a professor of GGP at Missouri State University. Thanks for stopping by, Matthew.
Thank you.
Matt, you do something related to tectonics, but I'm not sure what tectonics actually is. So tell us a little bit about tectonics.
Tectonics is the study of Earth's tectonic plates and how they move around in relation to each other and the resulting features that are created at the surface.
Now, you do something a little bit more than that. You're actually working on a specific topic within that. Tell us a little bit about that.
My team focuses in on understanding how mountains are formed, and not just the processes that create mountains, but when are those mountains being formed, and then the impacts that they have on the surrounding landscape.
Now, what does that require? Do you go do field work or do you do primarily lab work or what?
We spend about half of our time in the field doing research. Generally over the summers, we go out into the western United States and conduct some of our research there. And then over the winter, we spend some of our field time in the southern Appalachians.
Okay. And so when you do this field work, you bring back gigantic rocks or do you bring back gravel or what kinds of things do you bring back exactly?
We usually sample about a 5-pound chunk of rock. And from that sample, we can reduce that down and get the components that we need for radioisotope age dating.
So you're age dating. Well, that's interesting because, you know, when you think about the Earth, you're taught in science class primarily through all the various techniques that the Earth's 4.5 billion years old. So why don't you just get an age of 4.5 billion years for everything you date?
So when Earth formed 4.5 billion years ago, an early sequence of rocks was formed, but those rocks have been largely consumed through erosion or tectonic processes. So everything we see at the surface is much, much younger. Some of the oldest rocks that we found on the surface are between 3.7 and 4 billion years old. Those are the oldest, and those are really hard to find. Most everything else is significantly younger.
Okay. And so when a rock forms, all these processes are at work, but then you say you use radioactive dating. How do you know enough about the way the rock forms to possibly use radioactive dating to figure out the age of the rock?
One of the systems we use is by dating the mineral zircon, and we focus in on the concentrations of uranium and lead that are within the zircon. And since uranium decays to lead, then if we measure the uranium and we measure the lead, we can figure out how long it's been since that single mineral formed.
Now, how do you know that there's not a bunch of lead in the zircon when it got formed at the beginning?
Oh, that's an excellent question. So there are different isotopes of lead, some of which are not radioactive. So we use the ratio of the non-radioactive lead to the radioactive lead to see if there was a bunch of initial lead in a single mineral when it formed. If there's very low amounts of the non-radiogenic lead formed through radioactive decay, we know it did not have any initial lead when it formed, or
so
very low.
So what you're saying, and a lot of people might not know this, is that when things are radioactive, it's not like they just decay to one other thing, but instead there can be a whole chain of decays. Is that right? So if you talk about uranium-238, that might be one you would use. How many decays along its merry little way does it take to get down to lead?
Many. And so uranium-238 initially decays to thorium, and then that just starts a chain of events where it slowly decays to different isotopes of different elements before it ultimately becomes lead-206. Once it becomes lead-206, it's stuck as lead-206.
Now, which lead is not radiogenic? That is not the product of a radioactive decay.
It's lead-204.
So in other words, you got some small amount of lead-204 that you know doesn't come from anything else. And if you can find out how much of that is, then you can infer back how much of the lead was in the zircon grain at the beginning.
Yes.
And then you subtract that out and essentially work with whatever else is around. Is that right?
That's correct. And usually when we take that out, it doesn't really change much because there's so little lead-204 in these mineral grains even now.
Now, of course, if the mineral grain somehow had a physical process by which lead could be brought in from the outside, that would be bad. So what, they're impervious to outside influence, or how does that work?
Zircon's a really resilient mineral. So zircon is very resistant to chemical and mechanical weathering. It's a very hard mineral, too, so it's not easily broken down. And it does not weather easily through chemical processes or water affecting it. So it's able to survive in a lot of different environments, and it resists a lot of these processes that would add lead in. if lead is put into the system, we would see it from the amount of that common lead or that lead 204.
Right. Very, very interesting. So now you've got these grains. Let's talk a little bit about the why. Why would you do this? I mean, is it just a basic knowledge thing, or are there broader things at work here? I mean, a lot of people would say this probably helps petroleum industry, but I don't think this particular thing necessarily does. So why are you involved?
It can impact a number of different either petroleum industry or mining resources, can have some peripheral interest in these things, because if you know the age of a mountain chain, that might influence when certain features around it that may have oil and gas are related to it. Mountain building events also are sometimes have ore emplacement, where you get things like where you get events like gold and silver and molybdenum. Those things can move around. Those are very precious resources. So if we know the age of the mountain building event, we can go around and find other potential resources that are of things of the same age.
But your funding, for example, probably comes from people who are more interested in the basic science. Is that right?
True. We're usually funded by the United States Geological Survey to provide the base level field work, where we go out and we construct geologic maps. So to construct a geologic map, we go out and we try to find the different rock types as they're distributed in a single, very defined area. And what we like to focus in on is trying to find where geologic faults are located. A lot of people think of faults and they think San Andreas Fault. That's one type of fault. There are other types that form the mountain belts that we study. And we try to hunt those faults down by finding those different rock types around the fault.
Right. And would you publish your information? Presumably, would these be technical briefs, or would they be more like journal articles?
You get both. So with the United States Geological Survey program, they want our products published through the local state geological surveys. So when we're working out west in the state of Idaho, the Idaho Geological Survey would publish our results. When we're working in the southeast, the Alabama Geological Survey would publish any sort of geologic maps down there. And then our age results we would publish in peer-reviewed journals.
Now, with the different kinds of radioactive dating you do, kind of what sort of a range of ages can you find? Are we talking about most people think about dating, they think carbon-14, which of course is inapplicable here. That's for a biological organic material. And so what kind of age range would you talk about?
With the uranium lead radioisotope dating, we can date any age Earth material. Some of those oldest ages that I spoke of, the 3.74 billion year old age measurements that we've had, are from zircon in really old rocks. Younger geologic material can be dated the same way. We just use different isotopes of uranium decaying to different isotopes of lead.
Right. So that means that you need to know a reasonable amount of chemistry. So in your particular field, what do? Radiochemistry, nuclear chemistry? Do you take a lot of courses in that kind of work too?
We usually have very specific geoscience isotope geology courses, where we cover the isotopes that are applicable for the geological aspect of it.
Now, you and I talked a little bit briefly about another interesting thing to me. Most of this decay that occurs is going to be a combination of alpha and beta decay. And so the alpha particles, well, that's essentially a stripped helium nucleus. And so where do those go? Because you told me something I thought was pretty interesting.
So when a zircon grain is in a rock that's at a high temperature, the helium is a helium particle is created through alpha decay, and it's able to escape easily from the lattice. So when that uranium to thorium decay kicks out an alpha particle, it's able to escape and it leaves. Once the grain cools, or the rock cools with the grain in it, the lattice structure of the zircon contracts and it becomes more rigid, and it prevents the helium from escaping. So the helium is still trapped in there, and that allows us, through another type of dating process, to go in, heat that grain up, and extract the helium. And that actually tells us when a rock cooled compared to when a rock was formed, like the uranium lead technique.
Oh, that's interesting to me. And so the heliums can't get out. They're trapped actually interstitially inside, you said, I think?
Yes.
So they're inside the lattice in between the zirconium atoms.
Zirconium, silicon, and oxygen.
What, that's it, okay.
And silicon.
Okay, so let me ask you this. Would they, can you do spectroscopic studies of these grains and actually see them different because of helium in there? A physicist would think, oh, the helium is going to distort the lattice, and so it's going to somehow change the spectroscopic properties of the material.
I'm not aware of them doing that, but I have seen them do the atom tomography, where they can see the atom probe tomography, where they can see where the different uranium elements are distributed throughout zircon grains, which is really pretty neat because they appear to be actually clustering together instead of being randomly distributed throughout the zircon.
That would have had to happen at the higher temperatures, you would think.
Probably when they're formed, yes.
Okay. So have people studied the chemistry of formation of these? Are there people in geochemistry labs that are actually making new zircon grains with uranium in them, presumably?
That would be an experimental petrology thing, and I'm sure they do create those. I'm not familiar with it, though.
Okay. That's interesting to me because I'm interested in alloys a little bit, and so you think an alloy with uranium in it. What percentages of the uranium might this have of uranium in it? Are we talking parts per million, or are we talking larger than that?
It can have 200, 300 parts per million is pretty common, but up to thousands of parts per million. In fact, zircon is such a good host of uranium, and it's so resilient that some people have even talked about synthetically creating zircon to store nuclear waste.
Okay, as part of the long-term storage solution. Mm-hmm. Fair enough. What kind of a team would you put together? What does your team look like?
So we usually have numerous master students working with us. This fall we'll have, I believe, five or six master students working on our team, with between three and five undergraduate students, all geology students working on the team, either on the field component or the lab component, or potentially both.
Wow. And so do you work with other faculty members also at other institutions?
We work in-house with some of our faculty members. Just recently we finished a study with our geophysicist, Dr. Kevin Mikas, working in western Idaho. And we were able to do the surficial geology, look at the rocks at the surface. And he was able to use very detailed measurements of gravity changes over a long distance to infer the rocks down at depth. So from coming at the surface with our end of the study, we were able to couple it with his ability to look deep into the earth and get a better understanding of the geology of the area.
Yeah, Kevin's been in here to talk. He's got a lot of interesting things going on. Well, you know, we've talked about a lot, and it's fascinating stuff. I hope to learn more about it myself as you and I talk in the future. So, Matt, thanks so much for stopping by today.
Thank you.
And this is Dave Cornelison for the web version of STEM Spots, signing off.
STEM Spots is available online at ksmu.org.